that will be after the net at 12:45, quarter one in the morning. Fortunately, we'd lose the repeater. I think it would be fun to have the maybe, you know, go on simplex or something. If anybody's up to watch this thing go up, get on NASA TV on your computer or the SpaceX website, and they'll have this thing live. Let me drop it. Launching out of Cape Canaveral. They are going to attempt to bring the booster back to Cape Canaveral this time, instead of the drone ship that they've been using. The drone ships are usually around 200 or 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, and they usually land on that if they're doing a geosynchronous flight where they're using so much power and fuel that they don't have enough fuel to come back to Florida. This time, you know, it's very similar to what they did last December with CRS number 8 when they brought the Dragon up to the space station. And they brought that right all the way back to Florida. And again, that was a night flight. So you're going to see a big bright light come down. And they have lights at the launch pad. And that should be very interesting. They have a main mission of bringing stuff up to the space station. It'll probably be about 5,000 pounds of science equipment for the space station. Another roughly 1,000 pounds for the crews that are on board. There are now 6 people on board. Let me drop it. They have a new crew that just went up last week. One person from the United States is Kate Rubin, Dr. Kate Rubin from Connecticut. She has a doctorate in biology and DNA sequencing and all of that. She's going to be doing that on the space station. And one of the pieces of equipment going up on SpaceX tonight is a DNA sequencing machine. So they want to see if it's doable and if they can do any science with this. And they have the right person up there to do that. So that should be pretty good. In the back of the Dragon spacecraft that's going to be berthed to the space station, actually, to the Harmony module, maybe the Unity, I'm trying to figure out which one they're going to use, but in any case, they're going to berth it to the space station and unload it. In the back of the Dragon, they call it the trunk, they're carrying the IDA, IDA. The IDA is the International Docking Adapter. And this thing weighs a little over 1,000 pounds, and over time, after it's docked, they'll use the robotic arm on board the space station, the Canada robot arm, to pull IDA out of this trunk, and they'll be doing a spacewalk at the same time to attach it to the PMA, the pressure mating adapter number 2, which is attached to the forward portion of the International Space Station. They need that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Is building a spacecraft. Let me drop it. Called the Starliner. And that will be, you know, have crew on board. And they need this new docking system for that spacecraft. As well as the Dragon. The Dragon, although they're setting up cargo, they have a crewed version that they're building, and probably the first flight, test flight, might be at the end of this year, or probably the beginning of next year, and that will be, they'll be sending up initially two astronauts, but you know, on a regular basis they'll be bringing up 4, but they ought to be test flights, they'll be bringing up 2. You know, the same for Boeing, the same for SpaceX. When they do their test flights, they'll have one person, one astronaut will be NASA astronaut, and the other astronaut will be, commercial astronaut. It'll be either somebody from SpaceX or somebody from Boeing, something to look forward to. They did launch a Progress ship Friday at 5:30. I did see that on NASA TV. And I should be docking with the space station shortly. That's probably a two-day flight for Progress. They normally could do it in 6 hours. The Progress is an upgraded spacecraft. They made some improvements to the Progress, as well as the Soyuz spacecraft that Kate Rubin and her two crewmates went up with last week. That was an upgraded spacecraft. Russians made some pretty good improvements on that. And that'll be the last set of improvements. They've done that over the years, a lot of different iterations of the two spacecraft, the Progress and the Soyuz. But the next one that will be built will be the Federation. And that'll be a lot different. I think we spoke about that on a previous net. Let me drop it. And that's the main thing that's going on actually tonight and next couple of days. They'll be docking the Dragon with the space station 2 days from now. And there's other things going on at Cape Canaveral. Moon Express has taken over one of the launch complexes. They plan on using Launch Complex 17. And they're not going to use it for launch anything, but they're going to be using the area for testing their moon vehicle, which they plan on landing on the moon. They hope to launch it at the end of 2017. They're part of that Google Prize. They want to win the $20 million or $30 million. I think it's a $30 million prize. It's going to be probably divided up among the first and second place, or maybe even third place, are people that succeed in landing on the moon and then somehow moving on the moon 500 meters, roughly 1,500 feet, from one place to another, sending high definition video. Now, one other thing I always bring up before I turn it back to you, Dick, is China. Let me drop it. They have a very active space program, and within probably 2 months, they'll be launching the Tiangong 2 space station. The space station is being delivered this week, and that will be getting... they'll be getting ready to launch that. And once they do, probably end of August, beginning of September, they'll launch that. And then 1 month later in October, they'll be sending a two-person crew up to occupy it. And they'll be able to not stay there permanently. It's really only good for about 30 days. And then they have to leave. And then future crews will be going up to Tiangong 2. I had to mention that. One other story, I don't know if anybody saw it, some article said that they found Morse code dots and dashes in the dunes of Mars. They look down from the satellites and hear these dots and dashes. So I thought, as I'm reading this, I thought they were going to be talking about, let me drop it, the real Morse code that's written on the wheels of Mars rover Curiosity, and they do have dots and dashes, JPL, it's actually in the wheel. As the wheels roll across the surface, you could actually take the navigation cameras, they take pictures of it, gives them a good idea of how many times the wheels rolled one way or the other. One of the methods that they use to see how the rover is doing and whether or not it's in a sandy condition. There's other methods too, but electronic methods. But that's a visual way of doing it. I thought they were going to be talking about that, but they were talking about the dots and dashes looking on the from the surface. And I always get a kick out of those stories, like the Martian faces and the pyramids and whatever is built on Mars. But, of course, there's nothing to it. It's just the way the dunes are formed. Jack, I'll turn it back to you. There's other things, but, you know, I could go on and on here. K2RIWWS2N, space portion of the TechNet.
Pretty fine, Paul. Falcon 9 tonight at 12:45 a.m. Too bad we don't do what used to be done for the space shuttle missions in the beginning. The 147-000 repeater used to repeat astronaut audio from the space shuttle on each one of those launches. And it was one of those periods of time when the receiver they were using, the downlink receiver for NASA Select, which gave astronaut audio and video, and the audio was being played over the 147-000 repeater, 1982. I guess it was September of 1982. I think it actually happened in August. It was a launch. Let me drop. Where their downlink receiver had failed. And I happened to have a television receive-only terminal, a 10-foot dish that NASA Select. I was getting astronaut audio. So I started transmitting astronaut audio into the 147-000 repeater to substitute for the fact that their receiver had failed at that period of time. Various people started asking, who's doing that? And I revealed myself. Believe it or not, that was the event that began the technical net. People started asking, how are you doing that? What kind of equipment are you using? What else do you do? How high is your tower? And I started asking questions like that. And pretty soon they asked me to come back next week and give them more information. And that was the birth of the TechNet, 1982, September. All because of a downlink of astronaut audio from the space shuttle had failed. And look what that turned into. Yep, N2FDJ came along and said, gee, why don't we do this every week? And that lasted for a significant period of time, and eventually the TechNet got switched over to LIMOC. Because in New York City, it was a lot more difficult in those days to keep track of disruptive people who decided to jam the TechNet. So it got shifted. It's a lot easier to monitor that kind of operation out here on Long Island. So what is Falcon 9? It's a cargo ship, probably 5,000 pounds of cargo. I think you told us. And right now I'm also watching. Let me drop. I'm watching NASA's so-called Deep Space Network now, which has the URL of http://eyes.nasa.gov.esn/dsn.html. You go there, and you'll see the three major ground stations of NASA in Madrid, Spain, Goldstone, California, and Canberra, Australia. Beautiful picture of each one of those dishes. And right now I've clicked on the Goldstone dish, the big 240-foot dish, which currently is monitoring New Horizons. That's the one that just swished by Pluto. And it tells us that we've got a round-trip communication time of 9.69 hours. The distance to that spacecraft is 5.23 million kilometers. Tell you the azimuth elevation and wind speed and the picture of the dish, a live picture of the dish that's doing that reception right now. I did this with Voyager, let me drop. A couple of days ago, Madrid, Spain was downlinking Voyager. And, no. I was looking at Juno. Juno is the one that just flew by, just went into orbit around Jupiter. And, As I remember, they didn't give me the number of kilometers of range. Oh, no, they did give me the kilometers of range. They didn't give me the velocity. I was looking at the kilometers of range, timing how long it took for one of the digits to move, calculated that amount of time, and I think I came up with something like 84,000 miles an hour. It's the rate at which Juno is moving away from the Earth right now. A lot of that is Earth motion. Well, we're in our part of our orbit where we're moving away from Jupiter. rate at which the dish in Spain, I think it was increasing in elevation. And I realized that as I calculated that, yeah, that's the rate at which the Earth turns. So as the Earth turns, the dish has to move in order to keep aiming at the same point in the sky where Juno was located. This is an exciting website to look at. Sometimes they give you the downlink signal strength. And in the case of Voyager each time they do that, I think they give you the downlink signal strength. In some of these cases, they don't. But it's a fun website. So this Falcon 9 gives a few more words as to what it's bringing up. And I think that mission is like once every 2 months. They need another 5,000 pounds of cargo of consumables to keep all those astronauts happy. Over to you, Paul, on that. WS2N, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Yeah, it's probably about 7 or 8 flights per year between the United States with Dragon going up and the Russians with Progress going up and Japan with H2. They always have the H2, HTV. HTV is the cargo vehicle for Japan. They bring up quite a bit, almost 10,000 pounds. Dragon can't bring that much up. Dragon has a little bit more weight behind it because it has parachutes and a Pika heat shield. It's the only ship really capable of bringing stuff back, large quantities of stuff back to Earth when they land near Baja, California. HTV by Japan burns up in the atmosphere. Progress burns up. And then Orbital ATK, they launch out of Wallops, Virginia, and they'll be doing that again this August, next month, and end of the month, with an upgraded rocket, and they'll be bringing up cargo to the space station as well. They do not return anything they burn up as well. Let me drop it. So you got, four different cargo vehicles going up. When a crewed vehicle comes back on a Soyuz, I think they can bring like 100 pounds of stuff back. That's about it. Just a crew. That's pretty much it. Deep Space Network. Yeah, I was looking at that earlier, and it's fun to look at the antennas. When they say they're pointing them, the elevation is 45 degrees, and you click on that antenna. That's what the antenna is doing. You can tell it's 45 or 50 degrees. I was looking at one tonight. It was 23 degrees, and you can see it's low on the horizon when you look at the antenna. The different ones that you're clicking on. Australia right now is the only one in daytime. The other ones you can see it's dark, and you can see it's lit. They have lights on it. It does make you think that. I mentioned this last week during the interviews that NASA was having when Juno was going into the orbit. Let me drop it. If you could look in the background and you could see on one of the screens, they were using the same identical website, the Deep Space Network, what was going on. Well, interesting enough, watched a special on the Science Channel. And which is a very good show, by the way. If you get the Science Channel, they do have a lot of good documentaries. And they have one on Juno. And they showed it in the background quite a bit. You could see that antenna. The antenna is operating on the exact same Deep Space Network that we're talking about that we keep going on. They had it more so. And by the way, they did a very good job. They made it look a lot more exciting than what NASA did in their presentation during their documentary. With the music and all, they do good. And to bring it up to date with Juno on their 53.5 day orbit, they'll be coming back. I think the 17th of August they'll be going close to Jupiter again. Let me drop it. And they've refined their orbit a little bit with the thrusters, not the big engine. This time, when they go close to Jupiter, they'll have all their equipment on. They had everything shut down. They didn't want anything on. They wanted all the power, everything, just for the engine to fry for that 35 minutes to slow it down. But this time when they come close to Jupiter, and like I said, it's a 53 and a half day orbit, they'll have all their science instruments on, including the Juno cam. You know, they consider the 8 instruments on board all science instruments. There is one other thing, and it's called the Juno cam. They don't consider it a science instrument. It's the people's camera. You could vote. You can get on a website, the Juno website, and vote which you want. It on 6 days after going into orbit last week, and so now that's working, and they took pictures of Jupiter and some of the moons, and with low resolution, so it still looks pretty good. Now they're going to have high resolution. They're going to come right over the top of the planet, and that should be very good. And eventually that orbit, I think they're only going to do two orbits like that, and then they're going to fry it up big engine again. I think it's a pretty long burn as well. And that will get them into a 14-day orbit. And they'll be doing this for 37 orbits, or roughly 20 months. At that time, they're going to deorbit the spacecraft and let it burn up into the atmosphere. But they're going to do it slowly. So each time they pass, they're going to have their equipment on, sending information back. Until finally, you know, it will burn up. That's the latest on Juno and the Deep Space Network. We have all kinds of information. I, for one, want to keep Hubble going. That capability is there. They should do that instead of deorbiting it. You know, there hasn't been a mission up there for a long, long time to service it, but it's going well. They just got a 5-year extension on that. I think I read that yesterday. We'll see how Hubble goes. Be ashamed to deorbit that. Back to you, Dick.
As I remember, in the recent times, in the early times, Hubble had failures of power supplies and amplifiers and whatever, computers. But in all its repair missions, the computer, major portion that was replaced, lots of inertial wheels were replaced. And after the very last mission, I hope they found some kind of magic formula to make sure those inertial wheels keep on working for a longer period of time. Or maybe there's a way they can use them more gently that doesn't stress them. Because if your inertial wheels, which do most of the pointing, fail, then Hubble becomes kind of useless. I'm with you. I don't want Hubble to be brought back into the atmosphere. I'd like to see another repair mission. Arguably, that is the most productive piece of hardware that NASA has ever produced. And by way of the James Webb telescope, it's going to take over some of that function, but not until 2018, if it launches on time, maybe 2019. And that's more infrared than visual, whereas Hubble is doing a beautiful job of infrared, near-infrared and visual, and I guess a little bit of ultraviolet. But my goodness, is that a productive piece of hardware? Let me drop it. Juno, yes, made a 35-minute burn to get into this orbit, which is a 53 or 54 days orbit. After the second 53-day orbit, it makes another burn for 35 minutes. And then it's in a 14-day orbit for the next, 39 orbits or so. And the question was asked by a number of reporters, why didn't you guys just do a 70-minute burn? And one of the answers given was that that particular rocket engine had been tested for 35 minutes, had never been tested for a continuous burn of 70 minutes. They were afraid to push it that far. Take what you can get, if you know what I mean. Go easy with it, what they seem to be doing. And so Juno, you've made some predictions, Paul, 1 or 2 weeks ago, as to how great they think they might get failures of cameras, computers, or whatever, even though all of their vital equipment is inside of this 400-pound, third of an inch thick or half an inch thick titanium vault that's supposed to protect it from the radiation belt of Jupiter. Let me drop it.
I have a question for Paul.
Fine, John. So, Jupiter has a radiation intensity that's something like 20 million times stronger than the background radiation we experience on Earth. So it needed a lot of protection. So when it comes back to you, Paul, bring us up to date on NASA's prediction as to what failures they might get and when. Is it the camera that's partially outside of that protective vault that might give them a failure? But over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Dick, you might know also, I believe that they have scheduled a dual mission. That's why they extended Hubble 5 years, because they want to do a dual mission with Webb and Hubble together. Have you heard anything about that, either one? KC2WGB.
I think I have. Fill us in on that one, Paul. Fill us in on all of the above.
Well, like you said before, you know, James Webb is primarily, you know, infrared, and Hubble is in the visual, and it goes into a part of the infrared, and also James Webb goes partially into the visual as well. So it's not a complete overlap. So it's not that James Webb is a replacement for Hubble. So they could work together, and they got 5 years. Webb gets up there in 2018, end of 2018, so that there will be some kind of a crossover. But I would like to see an extension to Hubble. They really did a good job last time on STS-125 when they went up there, and they had one spacewalk after the other. And they really did a lot of upgrades, including the gyros, the six on board, and they replace them. You know, they pretty much all new ones. They need three. If four go down, they're out of business. But there are six. There's all kinds of new upgraded batteries. You put lithium up there. So you know, it was supposed to last. They were hoping for 7 years. That flight went up in 2009. Here we are, you know, almost 7 years later. But it's in really good shape. Everything's still working, so they got a 5-year extension. What could happen over time is, you know, I mean, it's up, what, 350 miles up? But there are, you know, molecules up there. Eventually it starts to slow down, and over time, it'll, you know, they could lose control and it could deorbit.
Repeater, timeout.
See if I have it. Over time, it could deorbit, and you know, on STS-125, the last mission. By the way, they had 5 service missions that went up there, so STS-125 is the last and fifth one. And it's a little confusing. NASA, if you read it, it looks like there's 4. They always say 4, but what they did, there was so much on number 3, so they split that up to 3A, 3B. So it's really five missions. Well, STS-125 put a docking module, a docking collar, you know, where you could send the spacecraft in the future, and then it just so happens it's a match for what Boeing's going to have and what SpaceX is going to have. So you'll be able to dock with this thing. I mean, the goal is to send some kind of a spacecraft in the future, dock with it, and deorbit it and have a control burn over the Pacific Ocean. But it wouldn't be too difficult to have, let's say, SpaceX go up there, the robotic arm, you know, and dock with it. You can dock with it. It's going to have the same docking collar on the front. Problem is getting out of the spacecraft. You know, you have to exit the spacecraft through the front. You might have to make some kind of a change there, some kind of a T arrangement where you could do an EVA. And then a robotic arm and equipment in the back. I mean, we get involved with tonight, you'll see it come back and land back in Cape Canaveral. They'll take that booster and use it in the future. So bring the course down. And in fact, later on this year, there's a plan on using one of the boosters that have been recovered. I think they've done four of them now successfully. One of those are in good enough shape to be reused, and they plan on doing that later this year. So that will not be on a NASA flight, by the way. That will probably be on an SES-9 geosynchronous orbital flight. That's the way I'm thinking. We'll see. Anything else? Something about Juno. Oh, is the radiation causing problems? Yeah, they expect the camera to fail in after 7 orbits. And eventually other electronics could eventually fail, but they have it well protected in the titanium vault. The hexagonal shape. So, I got to lower this. You'll hear, this is Falcon Launch Control in the background. That's what I have on. NASA has come on with the with their coverage of the Falcon 9 launch. So yeah, the that spacecraft has got very good. It's a tank. I mean, even the solar panels, they say they weigh about 700 pounds. If you were to open them up on Earth, the spacecraft wouldn't be able to hold the weight. It would just break right off. That's how heavy those things are. So everything is, you know, beefed up. It's got some kind of a glass coating on the solar panels. And they're gonna really push this thing to the limit. It's a flying tank. Back to you, Jeff.
Very good, Paul. So Falcon 9, you can tell, is really getting ready for that launch. I presume the launch itself is a burn of what, about 10 minutes altogether, something like that, Paul?
Yeah, you've got a roughly two minute and 30 second burn on the booster, and then which is 9 Merlin D rockets, and after separation, that has enough energy to make it back to Cape Canaveral. They have little nitrogen thrusters on the front of it, which will rotate the booster 180 degrees, and then you'll have three of the nine ignite, and then that will start a burn back series to get back to Florida, and then again it will do almost a 180 with the nitrogen thrusters. And start dropping into the atmosphere, engine burst. You got 3 engines that come on, you know, midway down, slow it down. And then finally, right before landing, the final engine, the center engine comes on. And every one of their engines are gimbaled. And you also see puffs of thrust coming out of the top to try to keep everything there. Plumb as it's coming down. So that's the story. And then the Dragon itself has one Merlin engine on it. So it's identical to the 9 that launched this thing. And so that simplifies things. The difference is it does have a longer cone. I call it a cone, but you know, the coming out of the back, and that's because it's in a vacuum and they're able to do that, and that gives them a little bit better thrust. In fact, they increased the size of the cone recently. In doing that, they had to increase the interstage between the first stage and the second stage to accommodate the depth of that cone. You know, it actually made the Falcon 9 longer, so it's like, I think it's 229 feet or something high, so it's a very tall rocket, about 12 feet in diameter. Back to you, Dick.
That's a biggie. There are 6 inertial wheels on Hubble. they install extra ones? Was there always six? Do you have reason to believe that all six are still operational? And is there a way they can use them more carefully so that they don't go into a failure mode? Have they found a better way of building those inertial wheels so that they don't fail? That was a high failure item in the past. I think a lot of the previous repair missions were primarily motivated by replacing those inertial wheels. So if you've got six operating inertial wheels right now, three of them being used and three in standby service, that sounds like we're in very good shape for the next X number of years. We're 5 years into the last repair mission after it, and if we've still got all six of those inertial wheels, if none of those have failed, we're in good shape. But if they give us, in other words, if one or two of those have failed, would they still tell us that poll when we've got enough others let go, others ready to go on standby? Over to you, Paul, KQLAW.
I know they need three. They have to have three, but all six are running as far as I know. Everything that they put on STS-125 is still operating. I haven't heard of any failures, including the new batteries and the computer stuff, and they did a lot. They refueled it, it does have some kind of fuel on board. No, they don't use it that much. If they do, but they have to close the door, the aperture. So, no, this is going to be bad. I got NASA on in the background. But that thing is 100% from what I understand. In fact, I just read it was doing good. Yeah, we're over 5 years. That was 2009, and here we are 2016. So they were hoping for 7 years. They've pretty much gotten that. So now they're going to get another five, hopefully, unless something fails. There you go. They got that docking ring on there. What happens is, ever since Columbia burnt up, they really got nervous. So when STS-125 went up, at the same time, they had STS-124 standing by on, you have Launch Complex 39A and 39B. Well, both of them could launch space shuttles and did in the past. So it's one of the only times you had two space shuttles out on the launch pad at the same time. They had planned, they had a crew and everything in case they ran into problems. They were going to have a rescue mission. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think we've discussed that rescue mission in the past, and to put space suits on and transfer astronauts from one space shuttle to another, I think that's a maneuver that hasn't been practiced very well, certainly hasn't been done in space, two space shuttles up there at the same time, and there's a lot of details that make that a difficult thing to do. Back to Hubble. If you only need three inertial wheels and you got six, you could use three of them and the other three are on standby or a hot standby, or you could be using all six. If you've got two in each one of the three axes and you use them pairs, in order to do the same amount of reorientation of Hubble, if you're doing it with a pair of inertial wheels instead of one, then the amount of force you put on each inertial wheel is lower. Therefore, they would last longer, because I think it's the amount of force you put on them in order to reorient Hubble that I think is the beginning of a failure mechanism. That's a guess on my part. Have they ever said that they use all six simultaneously when they all need all three, only need three, therefore you're using all six of them in a more gentle manner? Have they ever said anything along those lines, Paul? WS2N, KQLAW?
WS2N. I don't know. I know there are some kind of air bearings, some kind of gas. Well, they use the word gas bearings. They spin at like 17,000 RPM, something like that. So, and that's pretty much it. Weather's good down in Florida. That's pretty much all I know about them, Dick. I think they have similar problems with a lot of these spacecraft that have gone up, including Kepler, and that's why they're in the Kepler 2
opening the door and using thrusters with the fuel on board. And the nice thing about using the thrusters is that they're not stressing your inertial wheels. So I wonder if they do orientation with thrusters. Is that what happens, Paul? Is that why the fuel is there? The US-2N, KQLAW?
I guess that they... Sometimes these things get saturated. Maybe they use it to stop that problem. Maybe to increase the orbit a little bit. Maybe they need it in case of space junk flying by. I'm not sure. I don't even know how many times they've used it. And I know John wanted to say something. Back to you, Dick.
You got it, John.
Just a quick comment on a number of thrusters. Three may be used for the active control of the device. The other three may be monitoring the response. That's a possibility.
I guess so. Now, when you're using these inertial wheels, do you use them as a gyroscope where you try to twist it sideways as a method of getting thrust to the Hubble? Or do you do it by speeding up or slowing down the wheel in order to get a turning motion? And if you're doing it by speeding up or slowing down a turning wheel, I can see how after a certain number of those maneuvers can accumulate a whole lot of RPM. Therefore, it's got to be unloaded to slow it down without reorienting, and therefore you've got to use the thruster. So I think the thrusters are the little rocket engine, so to speak, are used more frequently to unload an inertial wheel as opposed to really moving all of Hubble. Does that sound reasonable, Paul? That's a guess on my part. WS2N, KQLAW.
Yeah, I agree, and I think there, some space junk came by. They need that capability. But what's really going to save them is that docking collar. You know, then they could attach a propulsion module to it and blast them higher up. Anytime the shuttle went up there, and they did that five times, and they attached themselves to the shuttle, and they didn't have the docking ring at that time. They had another way of doing it, but it would be attached to the, they would attach it to the bay of the cargo bay. You know, so if you look down in the cargo bay, here's this thing looking straight up like out of the back of the cargo bay, and then they would go out there and work on it. So it'll be a challenge, I would think, to use Dragon, which is much smaller. Definitely doesn't have the mass that a shuttle has. Don't know how they would do that. I mean, this is people just talking. There's no plan for Dragon or Boeing to do it. But I mean, the docking ring is there. I wouldn't be surprised if they could, bring fuel up there to fuel it and bring up a propulsion unit up, bring up equipment that has to go in, new batteries and whatever. That thing was really redone. I mean, they changed out the solar panels and everything, I think, twice. So, and by the way, James Webb, they're sending that up with a docking ring as well, and there is no plan.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
If it had to, but, the chance of doing that a million miles out, getting somebody back safe. Wow, back to you, Dick.
To repair James Webb would have to be a robot mission. Absolutely not. You're not going to put a human being out there. No way in hell. Now, with that docking ring you've got on Hubble, that gives you the ability to go there with a robot mission that does repairs, refueling, or can any of the Elon Musk or other hardware possibly send astronauts to Hubble to do another repair mission? Is another repair mission on Hubble thoroughly out of the question? I mean, once before we said we're not going to repair Hubble, and we went back and repaired it. Is there anything in the talking phase where, when it's required, because Hubble is so productive, we want to keep it running forever, is there a good possibility that some of the hardware on the drawing board right now could do a Hubble repair some number of years in the future? What's your guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, KQLAW.
we'd go up there with let's say, three people, you know. One person to stay in the spacecraft and two people to do an EVA. Now, you mean spacesuits and all. They'll have all that. Problem is to leave the Dragon vehicle. The normal way that they go into, they'll be going into the space station through the nose of the vehicle. You know, similar to what they do on Soyuz. You know, the nose docks with it, and then the door pull back, and you know the hatch will be open, and they'll go in that way. Well, that's the only way you pretty much in and out to do an EVA. I mean, there is another door, but that's pretty much going to be used for when they land. I don't know. I don't think that one's really made to open close for an EVA. So they either have to do something with that, or out of the front, they would have to develop some kind of a T setup. You know, you would have to pull a T setup out of the, you know, out of the trunk with a robotic arm and attach it to the front of the Dragon, and then the front of the, you know, the run of the T would attach to the docking collar on Hubble, and then you could send a crew out in EVA suits through the front of the SpaceX Dragon, go out of the front, and then, you know, go out of the bull of the T, you know, and
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
That on shuttle, you know, they have like a T set up. You know, you went out through the crew part of the shuttle, went out back toward the cargo, and then there was a T type of thing, and the bull of the T would be part that was. Have the attachment to the space station, and then you come out of the run of it, and that's how you did your EVAs. You know, you wound up in the cargo bay, floating around. Back to you, there.
I got a question for you, Paul. Is there enough audio on the launch sequence of Falcon 9? Do you have the ability to download that audio into this repeater? If this repeater stayed on, question number one is, would you have the ability to repeat the audio for us on this repeater? And number two, is there enough audio to make it worthwhile, or can we only talk every minute and a half? What's your guess on all of the above, Paul? WS2N, T2LIW?
Yeah, well, there's two other stations that'll talk more. I'd probably be trying them in about, probably at 12:15. I know Spaceflight Insider has a very good conversations and interviews. That's Jason Ryan. He does a great job. He always goes to the launch sites. You know, he does pretty good. But then the main one to watch is SpaceX website. And they usually come on about, I guess, about 20 minutes or so, 20, 25 minutes before launch. And that would be good. Again, that would be that'd be probably around 12:20. And they have engineers and everything, you know, talking, and that's pretty good. But you know, to actually do the audio here, I'd have to hold the mic in front of the speakers and time out all the time anyway. I'd really time that out. Back to you, Dick.
Let's abandon that effort, though. We haven't got enough time to set it up right. This is the end of Technet number 1611. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. John, we're about to be cut off real fast. KC2WGB, KGYW, go ahead, John.
I'm joined now by Stephanie Martin, my colleague, working our lunch tonight, and she is...
And that's pretty much the way we go. It's not a low side. I have to hook up my Bluetooth back to you there.
Yeah, thank you for that try, Paul. Over to you, John, for the ribbon.
KC2WGB. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for joining the net, for the questions, and just keep them coming. My email address is julianbravo5@aol.com. Any questions? Just shove them in the mailbag, and I will present them. So everybody have a good time. Enjoy the hobby. Good night. call, Dick, and talk to you on down the lot. KC2WGB.
Okay. Good night, you all. Try to be kind to each other. See you guys down the lot. K2RW Chris.
73, and Rockfield used to do a great job on 145.430. They used to retransmit all the shuttle stuff day after day. They were great. I don't know what they do anymore, if they do that. But that was good. In fact, they had Story Musgrave. He actually ID'd for them. They got him to ID for that station. Back in there.
Yeah, that is well done. And Story Musgrave gave a very nice talk at Cradle of Aviation Museum for the Astronomical Society of Long Island. And beautiful presentation. And we had a chance to get up close with him, shake his hand, ask him questions, and so on afterwards. Bye-bye, you all. Think space. Think radio. Bye-bye.
You got a bunch of hands up there, too. Ready to make contact with people. Kate has a call. Kate, Ruben. And I think four of the other ones. 73 WS2, I'm clear.
The time is 12:20 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 12:28 a.m.
Amateur Radio Newsline report number 2020 with a release date of Friday, July 15th, 2016, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Breaking news. Amateur Electronic Supply, Milwaukee location, is reopening as a ham radio outlet. American Indian tribes prepare for an emergency earthquake drill. Ham celebrate U.S. Route 52 with, what else? A mobile station and Portugal hams get a mountaintop repeater. All this and more in Amateur Radio Newsline report number 2020, coming your way right now.
The time is 12:30 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. W2VL repeater system. Good morning. The time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. radio, repeater, system. Net tonight at 8:30 WQVL, repeater, system.
Kind of sort of